So I'm amazed that more guys haven't put that together. They haven't figured out. Maybe they sat in their mind and said, well, these guys are running a billion watts, and that's why these my simple loop can do it. Well, in some cases, the ionosphere gives you a good amount of reflection, but at those frequencies, you could be getting a huge amount of D-layer absorption. So the signal you're looking for, once again, could be the equivalent of a very weak signal, a very weak transmission. And the fact that the loop works, we've had the evidence there, we had the data, and just didn't understand what it was telling us. Good stuff. I believe as you make the loop a little bit larger diameter, you could make it to 0.1 and 0.2 wavelength of diameter if you wanted to, you're moving in the direction of dipole. The pattern will change a little bit. The gain will change almost to zero. And because you've got complete freedom of reorienting the as, the L, and the polarization, it's all a wash. You will find that peak. And so, if you want to build one 12 feet long wire, and instead of doing it on 75 meters, you're going to do it on 40, 20, or 15, go for it. It will work. If the pattern will change a little bit, but as you slowly slide from a loop antenna to a dipole antenna, the antenna doesn't suddenly crash and say, I'm going to stop working. You slowly slide from one mode of operation to the other, and in either case, if you resonate, you will radiate. And yet, where you radiate changes a little bit. Big deal. So, have you yet experimented with using that exact same loop, but just by retuning? I'll admit that your Q multiplier and whatever, maybe is not going to work. Bypass that temporarily. Go back to the simple antenna. But have you ever tuned it on 40, 20, or 15? Except for some reorientation, I think it's going to fly like a charm. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Nope, it will not work on 40. Try that. It seems to work somewhat on 160. Not as well as it works on 80 meters. 80 meters covers the entire band. Some may go across that band, just tweak it, and there you're in business. I can't find my notes on it. I had very detailed notes on how I did all the mathematics and figured everything, the formulas and everything that I did come up with. I did some research and came up with a lot more than, I can say, one, you know, if I hidden at the end of the, in the manual there type of foreshortened, you know, and loop antennas and things, you see, very little written about it, except for that one page or so. And yet, there's something, like you said, there's something going on that is, like, you know, if you possibly didn't try this, you possibly, I would be able to convince. But I think 99% of the amateur radio population mentioned this to them, and they kind of know what to do. You know, you're imagining it, but, you know, you must be hoping something that's giving you your head putting it apart, because it is, you know, until you see it yourself, it's hard to understand. But notice the way when it's put together, you notice the way you put the shield about an inch up of what I would say would be like second base. Diamond shape of it. They put the shield apart at that point. And at first, I said to myself, really, what is taking place here? Putting the shield apart right in the middle, and the way and that seems to be the whole criteria of it. If you properly put the shield at that point, I think that that makes a difference how much what there is there. That maybe I'm wrong, but I think I found, I guess I can't find all my notes on how I did all this. But I think that split at the top may be responsible for possibly making, controlling the operation of this loop in some way, changing the axis, capacitance, what exactly is splitting it at that point that they're doing over.
Okay, I can see how you can develop an opinion along those lines, but my guess is that may not be what's occurring. I think your center wire is what's really being resonated. your center wire resonated as a inductive coupling device. It's a magnetic field antenna. It's a magnetic field generator that you're transmitting. That's a magnetic field receiver. It is the 3.5 meg equivalent of a ferrite loop antenna used on an AM radio. That's a pure magnetic field antenna. It has zero E-field characteristics, the ferrite loop. It's got 99.9% H-field characteristics. And at first that sounds crazy. I mean, you're trying to receive a TEM wave and you're only emphasizing the E-field portion of it. That's perfectly all right. If you were transmitting through that loop stick, I'll admit the loop stick's not going to take very much power before it saturates, but if you were transmitting through it, as soon as you get a fraction of a wavelength away from that antenna, even though you transmitted nothing but H, magnetic field, Mother Nature straightens that all out. She says, I'm going to make it just the right ratio of E to H because I'm 377 ohm impedance, and that's the way I act. By the same token, you and I, we make a transmitter, and our transmitter might be a 4CX250D2. It generates a god-awful amount of E-field. It generates voltage. It doesn't generate any magnetic field at all that comes out of the transmitter. We apply that voltage to the output transmission line, and inside of the transmission line, it has just the right ratio of E and H to be 50 ohm characteristic impedance. Mother Nature straightens it out for you as soon as you're a fraction of an inch away from the transmitter down that transmission line. Even though your transmitter is not generating any H, you try to generate a TEM wave, just generating the E, and the H comes automatically. So that doesn't bother me. So the shield around your wire, your coax cable, your RG58, just the shield to stop you from picking up E-field locally, which would have been 60-cycle hum pickup and stuff like that. It's only the H you're involved in, and the shield has very little effect on the H. That's my belief. Now, you weren't happy with the way it operated at 160 meters. At 160 meters, it's going to be four times more narrowband, so tuning it is going to be a dog, if you have enough capacitance. And when you try to tune it up to 40 meters or 20 meters, the amount of retuning required is so drastic, you again may not have hit resonance. And depending on the size of the loop, you got to worry about the fact that the natural characteristic of the loop itself may hit resonance even before your variable capacitor network takes over. So I am positive that loop will work equally as well on 160, 40, and 20 when you really hit resonance. And hitting resonance is going to take some rigmarole and some experimenting. During your next transmission, I'm going to pick up the handy talkie so I can hear what you're saying while I go over to the bookshelf in the other room and pick up my copy of the handbook, ARL antenna book. I thought I had it here with me. I don't. I'm going to go get it. I want to see this article one more time. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yeah. I have to get the book right. I think it's in the 19th edition. Yeah, well, you're right. It may be that it has to be in some way or another change the variable capacitor or whatever, something there. I figured at the time, I don't remember how I came up with it, but I remember I worked out figuring out the variable capacitor around broadcast type around 350 PS would be ideal for it. It is burnier and everything. You know, it's got a good tuning range. To that point, what I mean by that, guys, it is very pronounced at the point where you would say resonating. It is very pronounced at that point. It is classically, if you were saying I'm using a grid distinguisher, I'd like to see that thing the way it would dip a grid distinguisher. It would give you a nice fast dip. That's what a gentleman earlier was saying. Look for that dip. This thing will give you a very deep dip. This is what, in fact, that's what amazed me. I put it together down in the basement shop, and I connected it up to, I used the grid dip meter. Of course, I used the grid dip meter, and I guess you remember another gadget that was added on it, filling that out, called the antenna scope, takeover.
No, I don't remember the antenna still. But, I know that most of these printed meters can also be used as an absorption wave meter and detector, and many of them have a place where you can plug in earphones so that whatever you're listening to, you can demodulate it and make it turn into audio. Go ahead.
Antenna scope. You look back at some of the, you have some of the older AMR systems. If you look back, either the advertising or how to homebrew it, the antenna scope basically, they called it a scope. It had a CRT, it had a meter on it, a 0.1 milliamp meter. And it basically had a, you took a resistor, what the value of the system was, and it had a diode detection in there. And on one side of it, connected, you had a loop, you put a coil. It was made in this little square box, in other words, one side was the input, which was the driver, was the grid of at that frequency. And the other side had the terminal, you know, where you hooked your antenna. And when you got to that frequency by turning the knob, the calibrated knob, it gave you the impedance, Dick. Sure you must have fooled with such a thing over.
Yes. It wasn't Millen, it was some other brand name, but they had this elaborate looking devices where you plugged in coils, you twist a knob, and it would measure the impedance of any kind of a circuit. You plugged in a signal generator, you did some knulling, and it was an impedance measuring device. You eventually came out with the resistance value and the reactance value. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Precisely. I did get 19th edition on that page. Okay, here we are. What did I do? Calculated the loop. How did I calculate? First, a squared plus b squared, 9 subtract 4.2 feet. That together with the Belvin, 8241. Captain once mentioned Julie did a thing for a school where, of course, we've seen some real good displays here on the ocean. And she took a videotape and she just let it run one strike after another. In fact, last week I saw some beauty globally. Looked at it and I said, scared the heck out of me. I thought, God, no bugs coming across here now. It was moving out of Sandy Hook, New Jersey. I could see the strikes out of Sandy Hook, one after another. Started moving offshore onto the water area. I said, oh boy, you know, something else you're in for it, but it's dissipated. But she took pictures of that, the video, and then she condensed it down, she edited it down, so, you know, with a, you know, sometimes pause minister or whatever, between strikes, and she knows the pauses, and we were looking at it, and you can see this fuzziness. In other words, the strike is not clean, it's like a fuzzy strike, you say zigzag, left, right, and all like a jagged thing, like you would draw. If you've seen, you know, the old, you know, comic book, you see Shazam, you know, he said lightning bolt would come down and you see that zigzagging, that it come down and then veer off and then come down and veer off, and all. In other words, how you would draw a lightning bolt. And it's amazing. Yes, it doesn't come straight down, Dick. Is it because of the way it's breaking down the air as it's coming down and looking for another path over?
Most lightning strikes, when you look at them as a photograph, it looks like a bare tree in the wintertime with no leaves on it, but the tree is upside down. The trunk is up high, and all the branches are down low, and one of those tips of the branches eventually touches the ground. A whole lot of other branches are false starts that don't go anywhere. Lots of people have looked at that for a lot of years, couldn't quite figure out what's going on. On top of that, we have all kinds of ways by flying aircraft in the clouds or whatever in which you can measure the electrostatic potential of the cloud. How many megavolts is in that cloud? And you know how high the cloud is, how big an air gap, it's got a bridge, and you know that air is good for 30,000 volts per centimeter, which is around 76,000 volts per inch. The dielectric strength of air under normal conditions is 76,000 volts for each individual inch. Well, you go through the calculation, and you rapidly come to the conclusion that the voltage in the cloud is nowhere near big enough to arc the distance between cloud and ground, which in many cases is a couple of miles. It turns out that the lightning strike starts out with what are called meter strikes, where it moves approximately 50 meters, which is around 150 feet. It moves 150 feet and stops. It's got enough voltage to break down the air for 150 feet. Then it stops for a fraction of a microsecond and waits for the next cosmic ray to come along that ionizes a path the air. Then it jumps the next 50 meters and waits for another cosmic ray. All of those zigzags you're looking at are the individual paths of the individual cosmic rays that all got linked up together. Ain't that fascinating? K2KEY, K2LAW. You can easily get over that balance. Just go ahead.
Okay, now, just the point of what it means. It's fascinating. I'll tell you to look at that. It's scary and it's fascinating. You know, you don't want to be too close to it. You have to be nice to observe it and assist it and see what Mother Nature can, you know, perform fantastic feats. Is lightning strikes, are they prevalent throughout the universe? In other words, is electricity prevalent through the universe? In other words, we never discussed, but does it take place on other planets, Victor?
Absolutely. Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, a number of those moons going around Jupiter have lightning. They've seen lightning on Jupiter. They've seen lightning on Saturn. A lot of moons have lightning. As long as you've got the right weather conditions where you build up an electrostatic charge, you will have lightning. It is universal. No, go ahead.
But what kind of weather conditions do we have on these planets? I thought that we needed an atmosphere like the, you know, like we have with clouds and all the things that we know exist here on the Earth. What exactly is going on up there if you say that the weather conditions, what kind of weather conditions are we talking about? In other words, is there lightning also on Mars, Dick?
I think the answer is no in the case of Mars. Well, I'm going to backtrack on that one a little bit. First of all, most of the lightning that we've seen are either on massive gas planets like Jupiter and Saturn, or the lightning that we've seen is usually associated with volcanoes. You've probably heard that whenever a major volcanic eruption takes place, a whole bunch of particles are pushed up into the air by the volcano. By some means that I don't completely understand, those particles become charged, and in a volcanic eruption, you almost always have a tremendous amount of lightning. So any planet that is geologically active will have lightning. Now, in the case of Mars, Mars has an extremely thin atmosphere, and to my knowledge, no active volcanoes at this time. But Mars does have some wind speeds that numbers like 200, 300 miles an hour. Very thin atmosphere, but very high wind speeds. And so just wind moving fast, picking up dust, can make lightning. All you've got to do, for instance, is have wind blowing in a factory that has a whole lot of dust from flour that's being processed or whatever, and you can create one heck of an explosion from the electrostatic buildup of any little particles. Any little particles being moved by something like wind will create a accumulated electrostatic charge, and that eventually results in lightning. And the funny thing about air breakdown, it follows something called the Paschen curve, P-A-S-C-H-E-N, the name of a man around 1890 or so who studied what voltage will break down the air versus air pressure. And as you go to lower and lower air pressure, it takes less and less voltage to break down the air. And then when you get above roughly 30,000 foot altitude, as you start getting to lower and lower air pressure, then the voltage required to break down the air goes back up again. So why does it have this dip at around 30,000 feet of altitude, 30,000, 40,000, somewhere around there? And the explanation for that is an interesting piece of physics. I'm going to save that one for you for next week, Mel. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Yeah, it sounds like a very fascinating subject that we can get everybody in on. And, yes, of course, I've heard of many times, you know, with explosion, like they were in the process of flour, that dust, that fine dust, stuff, you off and you have a mighty explosion. But that can explode in that vacuum, think of it as explosive material. But I just say that fine dust. Yet, if you go out to, out in Arizona, out in the desert starts to explode there. Oh, sometimes it blows in. It's a fog of fine sand and everything blowing around, swirling and everything like that. You've seen caravans going across the Sahara Desert, and they're dressed with that get-up, the nomad dressed with it. They have to wear the thing around their face and everything. They move that get-up. But it's a necessity out on the desert. Yet, you don't see any lightning out in these places. I guess, what is it? The loss of the necessity of having some moisture involved also, over?
I'm not positive that moisture is required, but the nature of the dust itself does count. On the case of a volcanic eruption, you've got a lot of heat, you've got a lot of gaseous material, you've got a lot of particles, and somehow that creates an electrostatic charge. The fine silicon sand you get that flows in Arizona, I don't think that makes lightning on the usual basis. I'm still a little bit mystified as to how a cloud accumulates charge just because water droplets are being accelerated upward by local air currents, local convection currents. How the air particles rubbing against each other accumulate charge is a little bit strange. Now, in the case of the so-called tribal electric effect, or the tribal electric theory, you take, for instance, rubber and certain kinds of plastic rubbing against each other. The classic case is a ordinary balloon rubbing against fur, like your hair. You rub a balloon against your head if you're not bald, and it accumulates an extremely large charge. You bring it over to the wall, and it'll stick to the wall by electrostatic attraction. So rubber and fur will, when in contact with each other, they don't have to be rubbed, just coming in contact with each other, the electrons will jump from one to the other, leaving the two items charged. My Van de Graaff generator, which you haven't seen, but my Wim Hof machine that you have seen, uses some of these effects. And how a simple rubber belt running through a Van de Graaff generator can generate 200 to 300 kilovolts on my little machine, and the really big ones they've got in museums that'll make multiple megavolts, is really a fascinating process of something so simple can make such extremely high voltages. As a signal generator, it has an impedance of 10 to the 11 ohms. That's a little machine of mine. When it's generating high voltage, if you put a couple of very heavy finger pins across those two vertical capacitors, you can short out the voltage that it's generating, and it stops doing it. It has an impedance of 10 to the 11 ohms. That is, let me think, 100,000 megohms. Is that a high resistor? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I remember that. We sat that whole night playing with that thing. And that was a bad thing, the way that clock between those two adjustable rods and the balls on the end of it. What happened when you turned that crank? It fascinated me quite a bit. Whoever else was there, everybody would want to give it a turn. You saw what happened there. And yes, the Van de Graaff, I had one. I had a fish here that had an electric motor at the bottom of it, a copper brush contact system, and a belt, a wide belt. Belt was actually one of these belts that were made to turn. In the old days, if you remember the machinery that was overhead belted, the lathes, and the different machines, you had an overhead leather belt or rubber belt, or I don't remember what it is or not. Whatever, they had that wide belt. I had one of those belts that was about, I'd say 5 feet. It was like 5 feet when I made two pulleys for it. Made a box and put on top of it one of these old floats from it, that used in the toilet that made out of brass that had that ball on top of it. Oh, what used to come off of that thing. That was really a sparker. And then I cleaned up the movie night after. I sang my 40s, taking myself to the school, thing. I don't know, wound up in the garage, eventually wound up in the room, throwing away the dog in the garbage. But I just say the amount of what that could generate, it's just phenomenal, the amount of power. I mean, the spark that come off those things. So it's a fascinating piece of equipment, you know, simple to make and everything, yet go explain what's happening, you know. It's like you say something, a phenomenon that for many years was just a curiosity thing. People use it for things, but there's sure a heck of a lot of science.
Good evening. This is the...
I'm kind of amazed that some of these machines were invented in the mid and late 1800s. That far back, they were into studying high voltage effects and generated all kinds of machines that would do it. And I think one of the first places where it was recognized is that, yes, the power belts that we used on water wheels and things like this to power a factory, that leather belt going between the wooden pulleys and metal pulleys in the factory would sometimes build up on a dry day at very high voltages. And so people rapidly discovered that some of the techniques by which you can build up electrostatic voltage. And the amount of electrostatic attraction is also kind of amazing. When I run my Van de Graaff generator, and by the way, the diameter of the metal ball that's on top of the belt system, the Van de Graaff generator, the diameter of the ball determines the maximum voltage you can put on that before it will arc over to the air. Double the diameter of the ball, and you can double the voltage you can put onto it. Assuming you've got a good air gap between it and ground, or it and some other object. I know because if I remove the ball on mine, and you've got a little bit of a brush mechanism inside, it'll only build up a couple of volts before it arcs over to the air. You don't even see the little corona in the air, unless it's a darkened room. Put the sphere on top, and all of a sudden it'll build up some really big voltages. I can arc a gap approximately 5 or 6 inches. And when you hold a fluorescent bulb at one end, a 4-foot-long fluorescent bulb, near that Van de Graaff bulb, and you will feel the corona slowly jumping over to the fluorescent bulb. You'll see the bulb lighting up dimly. But the, if I have a grounded bulb alongside, and periodically it's discharging to the grounded bulb, and so the voltage goes to near zero and builds back up in a couple of seconds, that difference in voltage changes the amount of electrostatic attraction to the long fluorescent tube, and that fluorescent tube, no matter how stiffly you hold it in your hand, it will wave back and forth. It's about 4 inches, not 4 ounces, a fourth on the far end of that fluorescent bulb, and you can't stop it from waving as the Van de Graaff generator is practically discharging. It's hard to believe that electrostatic force is that large. I'm going to leave you, Mel. I think we've had enough for one night. And so this was TechNet number 1,151 of the series that began in September of 1982. We're coming up to our 25th anniversary. Back to you, Mel, for any closing comments.
Very good. This is KQKQY. Yep, very interesting. I always enjoy it. Look forward to the highlight of my ham radio operating for the week in the TechNet. And the discussions are very informative, every part of it. Space discussions with Paul and Eric, his contributions that he made tonight were phenomenal. It was just very, very enjoyable as always. And many of the emails, let me tell you, we get a lot of emails that say this is about the best thing that's on the any of the local teams here. Nothing that basically compares with it, and we should just continue. So with that kind of support, I think we shall do it again next week. Thank you all for 73 emails. I'll try to answer whatever we can, as long as you keep it within the realm of amateur radio and things that we can discuss on the air, and not in any way be prejudiced against any particular maker or piece of equipment. I cannot answer that, or a servicing situation. Go over it, peruse over it, as they say, but I can't get definitive on a lot of these things. So what we discuss, what I do, bring up on the emails, literally once I filtered out that we have discussed on here, I think that most people would have interest in So with that, 73 is all. See you again next week. KQRIW, this is KQRIW 73, and have a good, great week.
Bye-bye, Bill. See you down the log. And we've never given anyone a guarantee that they're going to get a free, completely free consulting service by mail. So hopefully people can keep it simple. I know that a brand new amateur, when he first looks at all the catalogs, it's confusing. There's 40 brand names of everything he wants to buy, and he wants a recommendation as to which brand name. And as you know, Mel cannot answer that. That's not a fair question. We will, if anybody has enough requests, get on the air and everybody tells what their favorite rig is, what they like and what they don't like. That's valid. But for any one human being to say, everybody in the world should buy brand A, model so-and-so, and reject all others, that's not fair. And even if you give a list of all the candidates, that's not fair. Because in many cases, like the equipment you're listening to that I use, most of my equipment is 15 years old. So I have no hands-on experience with modern equipment. When it comes to what I do as an occupation, yes. What I do as a hobby, no. I'm behind the times. Why are you listening to me? That's a joke. 73-year-old, see you next week. Bye-bye for now. Be kind to each other. KQRIW clear with Mel.
Yes, and again, I'll overemphasize that the, your consulting business and our, I guess, our professional cannot cross over to amateur radio. I cannot, I will not ask Dick in any way to critique anything in a commercial end, or can I critique something that is, I guess, that you are using for a degree. A degree in either, you know, in a college or a business type of situation. So this at least cannot help you with, and I know I get a number of them, and they think that I can't go over page after page, nor will I add six new pages of information. Okay, so that's good night all. This is KQY.